So kind of transitioning to going towards the end of our time here, kind of the forge aspect of the New Testament documents, this seems to be like a big selling point even today. Do you see the study going forward more, or is it just we're constantly having to respond to the critic, where it almost seems like this hyper skepticism of, well, there was no Jesus, no apostles, so that Christianity just kind of appears somehow within the confines of history, that, or it kind of develops out of Hellenism, or I honestly don't know how you can be that level of skeptic, but. As far as you were saying, our best evidence is the New Testament documents in the book and in our interview here. Do you see more work needing to be done? Are there gaps in our knowledge that will break the bonds, if you will?
Well, Patrick, I'm really glad you raised that question, because it's an important question, what you might call introductory matters. And you know, we... colleagues of mine and I wrote a like 1200 page book, The Cradle, the Cross, and the Crown, where we deal with that, you know, for every one of the 27 books of the New Testament. So, because we think it is so important, anytime you study a book, right, in a small group or a church, essentially you always have to ask yourself some of those basic questions, you know, who wrote the book, to whom, when, where, and why. And I think the problem is that during the Enlightenment period, it became fashionable, almost required, to challenge long-held views taught by the institutional church. So there's this this almost like anti-tradition bias that the Enlightenment bequeathed on scholarship. And, you know, in some cases, this was good in that it helped the reformers recover the gospel of justification, you know, through faith by grace. But in many other cases, it was bad, because people felt compelled to overturn long-held beliefs, even when they're based on solid early evidence.
Yeah. Such so the reformers as the want Ed Fontes back to the sources, writings. But other people just threw everything out. Yeah,
exactly. An overreaction, I mean, a massive overreaction. If the church has believed something and taught something, it must be false. You know, just kind of like a rebellious teenager, right? I mean, parents, you know, can't do anything right. So unfortunately today, I think there's a great divide between believing scholars and critical or even skeptical scholars when it comes to authorship issues and introductory matters, because critical scholars typically have a very strong aversion toward like the titles of the Gospels, for example, and the explicit attribution of the New Testament letters to Paul, to Peter. And also remember, they don't believe in biblical inerrancy or inspiration. You know, they're non-confessional. They're basically agnostic or really have a low view of scripture, essentially. But I think one thing that strikes me again and again, when you actually look at it historically, history is usually not on their side. And I think that's very important because Bart Ehrman, he presents himself as a historian. He kind of taking the high road, right? And so then anybody who disagrees with him, they're just not as good a historian as he is. And so I enjoy sometimes taking him on the point of history. I'm saying, really? Okay. So the, you know, some of those authorship issues are, you know, they don't have sufficient historical attestation. What about the early canonical lists? The Muratorian canon dates to about 180. Irenaeus writes in the 180s as well. Well, they only acknowledge four gospels, the ones we have, right? So that's a lot sooner than the fourth century. And none of those Gnostic gospels are ever included in any early canonical list. So you have to ask yourself, why would people want, I always like to ask myself that question, why would want people to dispute the New Testament claims regarding authorship so badly in the first place? You know, what is the agenda that drives them? They make it look like we have an agenda, right? To just kind of like defend the Bible, but they have an agenda as well. And I think in some cases, it's just outright skepticism, not just toward the Bible, but toward Christianity and even, you know, toward God himself. So Bart Ehrman, I think maybe his one of his more recent books, he claims that many of the New Testament documents were forged. Again, why does he do that? It's obvious, right? To discredit them. In other cases, it may be specific teachings in certain writings that people try to set aside because they're inconvenient or offensive to them. For example, Paul's teaching on the role of women in the church in 1 Timothy 2. So, you know, by saying that 1 Timothy is late and forged, you can marginalize those kinds of teachings, and those people can claim they lack authority and don't need to be obeyed. So you see, there's often an agenda and ideology behind why scholars affirm pseudonymity or claim that the New Testament writings are forged.
Is there a book that you can suggest of covering the topic of the role of women in the church?
Thank you. Yeah. So this is a 25-year project where Tom Schreiner and I have, in three subsequent editions, about 10 years apart, written a book, Women in the Church, on 1 Timothy 2. And I mean, the exegesis is clear. Paul meant what he said and said what he meant, you know. And we go in that book, go through it, you know, one word at a time and say, I really means I, and not permitting really does mean not permitting, and so forth. But it's really been very helpful for the church, even universally in Australia and in the UK and in Germany, you know, because often people are questioning the exegesis of 1 Timothy 2 in an effort to, again, like we said, to marginalize that teaching because they find it culturally, you know, unpalatable, and they simply don't want it in the Bible.
Yeah. So sometime soon we'll probably see missionaries coming from China to evangelize the United States.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.